can argue that during the Civil War, four women changed the course of history through their acts of daring and danger. But always scrupulous, they were not. One used her considerable charms to seduce men from both sides. Another disguised herself as a man. A third engaged in affairs with northern politicians and used her daughter to get the information gleaned to the south. And a fourth operated an elaborate espionage ring, even placing a former slave inside the Confederate White House to get information. This is the true story that Karen Abbott spins in her fast-paced new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. And if you're wondering which one was the liar and which one was the temptress and so on, know this, all four were each of those. Karen Abbott is a best-selling author of Sin in the Second City and American Rose. She's a regular contributor to Smithsonian.com, and she joins me this morning from Nashville. And Karen Abbott, so good to have you. Good morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you say point blank in here that these women changed the course of history, Karen. How so?
Well, these were women who decided to go a bit further than women in their position usually would. When you think about women in the Civil War, most of them were darning socks and making uniforms and raising money for the soldiers. But these women really put their lives on the line. Rose Greenhow organized a Confederate spy ring right in the middle of the federal capital of Washington, D.C., and was instrumental in helping the Confederates win the first Battle of Bull Run. Without that battle, the war would have ended in 90 days, so that was a significant victory. And of course, she went on to much more devious acts after that. And on the Union side, Elizabeth Van Loo was sort of her counterpart. She organized a Union spy ring in the Confederate capital of Richmond. And as you said, she even went so far as to place a former family spy in the Confederate White House. And of course, it was illegal at the time to teach slaves how to read and write. So the fact that this slave, Mary Jane Bowser, was not only literate, but highly educated and had a photographic memory was quite astonishing. So while, you know, Jefferson Davis is leaving his papers and maps around and not thinking anything of it, Mary Jane is taking peeks of these and overhearing his conversations and reporting all of it back to Elizabeth. So these women really were quite remarkable in their attempts to help their sides win.
And it was really fun for me to read about Elizabeth because I was just in the Confederate White House for the first time a couple weeks ago for a family wedding. We had some time and we stopped in Richmond on that Sunday, and I just toured the house and have a very clear sense of Jeff Davis's office and know exactly what that's all about. Let's go to the story of Emma Edmonds, one of the women you haven't mentioned so far here. She's the one who disguised herself as a man to enlist as a Union private named Frank Thompson. You said that you especially connected with her, Karen. Why?
Well, I found her, first of all, she was only 19 years old when the war broke out. And she had been living as a man for 2 years. This was somebody who had a tragic upbringing and decided to just change her life and seek a life of adventure. She fled an abusive home up in Canada. She bound her breasts, she cut her hair, and she traded in her dress for men's garb and emigrated to the United States. And once she got here, she started hearing about the abolitionist John Brown and all of the drumbeat of events leading up to the Civil War. And she decided to enlist as Private Frank Thompson. And the fact that she got away with doing this for as long as she did was really remarkable. The medical exams, how she passed those, how she slept alongside her comrades and got away with that. And the fact that she lived in constant fear of discovery. This is somebody who was always on the front lines of battles and also so had to worry about death that way. Also was going undercover quite a bit and had to worry about those dangerous missions. And also just about finding out if she were discovered, she would be arrested, jailed, probably charged with prostitution. And in the worst case for Emma would to be kicked out of the army altogether. She really wanted to stay and fight.
You know, let's take a couple of these things you said and slow down and talk about them just for a moment here. How in the world would Private Frank Thompson, otherwise in real life, Emma Edmonds, how on earth could she pass a medical exam, Karen?
That's an interesting question. And U.S. protocol dictated that doctors follow stringent medical exams that they thoroughly, you know, examine every potential recruit. But the doctors all flouted these rules. They had to fill the lines quickly. They had quotas. They needed the men out there as soon as possible. So they might just check to see if people had their trigger fingers, if they could shoot a gun, if they had enough teeth to rip off powder cartridges. They didn't care if somebody was deaf. They just made sure he had 2 feet so he could march. So it was really cursory. And, you know, somebody might just get a tap on the shoulder. Emma, in particular, the doctor just shook her hand and said, what kind of living has this hand earned? And Emma said, up to this point, this hand has primarily earned a living by getting an education, never specifying what sort of education that was. But she was passed in and on her way.
Did you see, are there any photographs of Emma Edmonds as Private Frank Thompson that are still around?
There are. I have some in the book, and you can see. You know, she looks like a young boy in here, and she passed off her smooth face. She, you know, a lot of the young boys didn't have facial hair yet. Her higher voice, she said, you know, she was still a young man, so her voice didn't quite mature yet. These sorts of things. There were a couple telling details, though. Her feet were so small that she couldn't wear regulation army boots, and she had to bring her own boots. And some of her comrades actually called her our woman. So there were jokes about her being our woman, but Emma still, I think she impressed everybody with her valor and her bravery, and they all just admired her, and she was one of the guys.
Well, and she slept alongside her comrades, you said, and in those days, if I remember, I've seen pictures, the soldiers would sleep pretty closely together to sort of keep warm on those cold nights, and you sort of wonder how that worked for her.
Yeah, well, luckily for Emma, they did not change a lot. And you can imagine they bathed just as infrequently. Nobody was bathing or changing very often. They would even go to bed wearing their uniform and their boots to save time to get up in the morning for drill, since they had a report for drill so early in the morning. But I think that I came to the conclusion that the greatest reason she was able to get away with this was because nobody had any idea of what a woman would look like wearing pants. you know, people were so used to seeing their bodies pushed and pulled into exaggerated shapes with corsets and crinolines, that the very idea of a woman wearing pants, let alone an entire army uniform, was just unfathomable. And so just nobody saw a woman when they looked at her.
So no one was expecting to see a woman, so they just weren't thinking along those lines. I mean, did she ever have any close calls, Karen? Anyone come close to figuring out who she really was?
Well, Emma found herself in quite a situation pretty early on in the war. She falls in love with one of her fellow soldiers, another Michigan soldier by the name of Jerome Robbins, this rather dashing gentleman. And it's really a torment for her. And I sort of love this part of the story because she's so strong and so brave. And here's this vulnerability. And she did not expect this. And so she wrestles with the idea, do I suffer in silence? Do I keep this to myself? Or do I risk everything and tell this man who and what I am and see what happens? I love how their story sort of plays out throughout the book.
Well, she wasn't the only woman to impersonate a man in this war, as you found out. In fact, there were dozens of others. What do we know about that and how widespread this was?
Well, there is an estimated 400 women who disguised themselves as men to enlist, both North and South. And some of them were more successful at getting away with it than others. There were a couple stories about how women were discovered. There was one woman who a Confederate captain threw an apple at her, and she instinctively reached for the hem of her dress to try to catch the apple. And of course, there was no hem of her dress. She wasn't wearing a dress. So that sort of gave her away. And then there's the story of a corporal in New Jersey who gave birth while she was on picket duty. So that sort of gave her away, the fact that she was gave birth on picket duty. And Emma would hear these stories, and it was terrifying to her because it was, you know, one step closer to her being discovered. If she were injured, which she was during the war, quite often she suffered some physical disabilities and some injuries and wounds that were pretty serious. She was terrified to go to the medical doctor for help, lest she be discovered.
That is just amazing to me. And again, she just did this because she wanted the adventure, or was there? Did it go beyond that, Karen?
Well, she was a devout Christian and did speak about she did not believe in the institution of slavery, and she came into contrabands, which of course was the term for escaped slaves. And the more she came into contact with them, her conscience about slavery was further aroused. But mostly it was the sense of adventure. She wanted to know what part she would play in, quote, this great drama. That's what she liked to call the war. So she was an adrenaline junkie at heart.
How difficult was it for you to research her story? I mean, what was available to you to get this story down?
Well, she had a memoir, and I vetted that. I also read several academic books about her. And her memoir, like many Civil War memoirs, it's a little bit of self-mythology. And I always point out in the text where she's embellishing the story. But I think it's just as interesting what people omit and what they embellish as what really happened. Some of the stories that she includes that I say are embellished, it does give you an insight into her personality. So it was just a matter of gathering all of those sources and sort of acting like prosecutor. Here are the available facts I have. Here's the picture I'm going, the argument I'm going to make with the facts I have. And, of course, she turned out to be a very interesting case study.
Wow. Well, let's do this, Karen. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this very interesting conversation about women who served as spies during the Civil War, a story that's really sort of been lost to history. We'll find out how she brought this story back to life and more information about the other three women we really haven't talked about yet, including Elizabeth Van Loo, who hid behind her proper Southern manners and orchestrated this espionage ring that's just going to blow your mind. Just a very interesting story. Karen Abbott's book, again, is Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, this segment, we're visiting with Karen Abbott about a very interesting new book, a true story about four women who served as spies and soldiers and liars and temptresses in the Civil War. That's the title of her book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Karen, how about the other three women when it comes to unearthing their stories? Where did you go to find their stories, and how did you even know there were stories out there to get?
Well, the first woman I came across was Belle Boyd, who was this 17-year-old girl living in the Shenandoah Valley, Virginia.
And she had a temper, right?
Oh, yes. I was immediately intrigued by her. She was all id. She had no filter. And she was really surprisingly overt for the time, both with her opinions and her sexuality. She was sort of, if Sarah Palin and Miley Cyrus had a 19th century baby, it would have been Belle Boyd. Huh. And had quite a temper. She kicks things off early in the war in July of 1861 when Union forces are marching down to her hometown of Martinsburg. And they're rampaging and they're stealing liquor and they're breaking into people's homes. And Belle is waiting for them with a pistol by her side. So when one of these soldiers threatens to raise a federal flag over her home, Belle decides to shoot this man dead. And she gets away with it.
How did she get away with it?
Well, she claimed self-defense. The man had insulted and sort of made a move at her mother. And so that's what they reported to Union authorities. And at this point, it was so early in the war that Lincoln and Union officials wanted to practice appeasement. They did not want to make a Confederate martyr out of this girl. They thought the war was going to be over fairly soon, and they just wanted to sort of sweep an incident like this under the rug and just focus on capturing Richmond.
She was 17 years old at the time this happened. How did an incident like this shape her? How did it affect her, Karen?
You know, Belle was emboldened by this. She writes that, quote, her little rebel heart was on fire. And she goes off to become a courier and spy for the Confederate Army. And she had many relatives in the Confederate Army, and so used her connections to do that. And starts spying and getting information from Union officials. She notoriously seduced a Union general named James Shields. One Northern journalist reported that she was closeted for 4 hours with him. And then celebrated this conquest by wrapping a rebel flag around his head. She went on to become very obsessed with General Stonewall Jackson, the famous Confederate general, even telling people she wanted to, quote, occupy his tent and share his dangers. So she spends a lot of time, especially in 1862, trying to get Stonewall Jackson's attention. It makes for some interesting activity in the war.
this flag, the Confederate flag she wrapped around the Union general. Tell me what happened there?
Belle, all I read, this was actually a a New York Tribune reporter wrote to his editor, and he was just like, Belle Boyd is insane. she was closeted for 4 hours with Union General James Shields and then wrapped a rebel flag around his head. And it was just sort of this two-line thing, but just gave you an insight into, number one, how adept Belle was as a temptress and seductress, and two, you know, these Union men were just allowing her to go around their camps. And people would wonder about this. They would say, this is an open secessionist. This is somebody who rapidly declares her allegiance to the South. Why are we letting her wander around our Union camps? Not only that, but stealing our sabers and pistols. I mean, Belle went around and stole all their weaponry and sent it on to the Southern lines. And I think part of her disguise was that she was so brazen. She would go up to people and say, yes, I'm a secessionist and I'm a Southern spy. But really, if I were a dangerous spy, would I be standing here telling you I'm a spy? So it was sort of her tactic, and it worked.
Counterintuitive to the max here, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this notion that she was a woman wandering around these camps, to what extent was that just a huge asset for her being so out of place, at least on the battlefield, at least back in those days, as she was?
Oh, absolutely. One of the most fascinating things I learned about this time period for the book was how women could use their gender as a disguise. It was both a physical disguise and a psychological disguise. Physically, you know, they would hide secret dispatches up in their hair. They would hide sabers and pistols and medicine and all sorts of material beneath their hoop skirts and smuggle it across the lines. And psychologically, they just exploited people's idea of women being the weaker sex, the defenseless sex. So if any of them were accused of treasonous behavior, the immediate response was, how dare you? Such language and accusing me is beneath the conduct of an officer and a gentleman. I am a defenseless woman. How dare you? And of course, the men were immediately chastened, and it worked.
Well, let me get our listeners involved in this conversation, Karen, because the Civil War is always a very hot topic with so many folks who listen to Up to Date. Ladies, would you take actions like these to support your side in a war, even one like the war between the states? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Again, that's 816-235-2888. Again, we're talking with Karen Abbott about her new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. You know, these stories, Karen, were all but forgotten by history. How could that have happened? Because this is such incredible stuff.
Well, thanks. I agree. It is incredible stuff. And I just think, I mean, there's so much material available in the Civil War. I mean, there are 100,000 books about everything from, you know, generals' pets to, you know, Stonewall Jackson's arm, disembodied arm. Everything has been written about. And I just feel like women, when the women were written about, but they were written about in terms of what were they saying in their diaries? How were they talking about when their men are going to come back home and what's happening at home in the plantations? And I think that had been the primary focus. And I just was really excited to find another viewpoint and weave a tapestry of four women who did the war differently.
So you came across the story of Belle Boyd first. Is that what you said before?
Yes.
And then how did you find the stories of Emma, Rose, and Elizabeth then?
Well, I just started digging around. There were quite a bit of women who did try to make a bigger impact on the war, and it became a matter of sifting through all of them. There were several fascinating women I had to leave on the cutting room floor, and I picked these four women in particular because their stories all touched one another, even if they weren't physically acting together at all times. Although Belle and Rose do. They do meet and interact, and Belle sort of idolized Rose. Belle wanted to be Rose when she grew up, but they meet the same people, and there's a cause and effect of their behavior. You know, one woman's actions will affect another woman's circumstances. So I found it really interesting that you could create a tapestry with these four particular stories.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me because you're so right. I mean, what angle of the Civil War hasn't been written about and written about and written about? And here you found one that is something new and fresh. I mean, to what extent do you think these stories of these women have been forgotten to history because they were women?
Oh, I think it is to a great extent. You know, men were the ones writing the history books, and there were obviously many men to focus on in Civil War research, and the women sort of fell by the wayside. And if women's history, you know, did did become famous. You know, I think about Mary Chestnut, the diarist. Here's somebody who brilliantly chronicled Southern life as a woman, but she wasn't out spying. She was on the home front, and she had quite a few interesting, insightful things to say about war down south, but they didn't have to do with being on the front lines or going undercover. So there, you know, there are women's voices, just not these particular women's voices.
Hmm. You've said that you began thinking about this book more than a decade ago when you moved to Atlanta. Tell us about that. I mean, how did that move get you started thinking more about the Civil War, Karen?
Well, I was born and raised in Philadelphia, and so moving down south to Atlanta was quite a culture shock. I had to get used to seeing the occasional Confederate flag on the lawn, the jokes about the War of Northern Aggression, and just the fact that the topic of the Civil War does not seep into daily life and conversation up north as it does down south. And the point was sort of driven home to me when I was stuck in traffic for quite a few hours behind a pickup truck. The pickup truck had a bumper sticker that said, "Don't blame me. I voted for Jeff Davis." So I spent, like I said, quite a few hours behind this pickup truck and had some time to start thinking about, well, what were the women doing? I want to know what the women were doing.
Oh, so interesting. Again, our number 816-235-2888. If you want to join our conversation about women spies in the Civil War, you use quotes in these stories as you go through the book. How did you get those?
Oh, God, I have probably 50 pages of endnotes in there, exhaustive research.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, there is a wealth of material, primary source material, diaries. National Archives had quite a few bits of correspondence between Rose Greenhow and her paramours, all these seized correspondences, fragments of enciphered letters, just really fascinating detail that could bring the story to life.
Hmm. Did you ever consider calling this a work of historical fiction?
No, absolutely not. No, not at all.
Because?
Because it's not. As I said, I spent 5 years researching it. I have 50 pages of endnotes. If there were any embellishments, I make sure to say it in there, as all historians do. And narrative nonfiction is not academic history. It's an entirely different genre, and you approach it differently, and you tell the stories differently. And with narrative nonfiction, you gather every single available fact at hand, which I did, and then you sort of treat it like as if you're a prosecutor. I know this and I know that. I wasn't right there, but I can take the facts that I have and create a scenario. I can take the facts I have and create the story, the narrative that I think happened. And that's what I do. And everything that should be cited is cited.
You know, as you came across these women, you know, Emma Edmonds and Rose O'Neill Greenhow, how would you even know where to go to begin to look them up and get more information about their backgrounds?
You start with the general history books, and you eventually, get to the archives where the great material is. And it's sort of like a thrilling detective search. You never know what's going to be in the next box or what's going to be in the next folder. And I remember sitting at the National Archives and coming upon this black scrap of silk. This was a black scrap of silk and a little bit of a torn and ciphered dispatch. And I realized that I was holding in my hand part of the dispatch and the black silk that Rose Greenhow used during the first Battle of Bull Run. She summoned over a 16-year-old courier who was one of her spies and wrapped up this note in a patch of black silk and coiled it up in this woman's hair and made a bun and sent her across to General P.G.T. Beauregard's headquarters. And no one, of course, questioned her. And she gets to headquarters and lets down her hair and delivers this dispatch. And the Confederates win the first Battle of Bull Run. And to just hold that in my hand, knowing that Rose Greenhow had held it in her hand 150 years ago, was quite remarkable. Same thing with Elizabeth Van Loo at the New York Public Library. I actually found some of the death threats she received from white supremacist groups. One of them said, "Please give us some of your blood to write with." And I just thought, wow, it's so chilling to sit here and hold this. And I can't imagine how Elizabeth felt receiving this, back in 1864.
And those moments that you have as you go through so painstakingly and so arduously, as you go through the archives and to stumble across something like that, has got to be just a heck of a thrill.
Oh, it absolutely is. It's the best part of the job by far.
Hmm. Well, let's turn to the story of Civil War spy Elizabeth Van Loo, because this tale almost defies belief, at least it did in my mind. I mean, she's a wealthy society woman living in Richmond during the Civil War. and she did this extensive undercover work for the Union right under the noses of the Confederacy. She even had a secret room. Tell us about that.
Well, Elizabeth was always living in a precarious situation. She was a staunch abolitionist, which, you know, before the war, her neighbors sort of looked at her with a wary eye and thought she was odd. But after the war, that was a dangerous philosophy to have. That was something that could get her killed. And to make matters even more dangerous, Elizabeth's brother, John Van Loo, who lived with her in the home, was married to a Confederate woman. So Elizabeth is conducting all of her espionage activity right under not only the noses of Confederate detectives, but her sister-in-law, who was more than willing to report anything she saw or heard to the Confederate detectives. And Elizabeth did have a secret room in the mansion and decided, well, this would be the perfect place to hide escaped Union prisoners. And that was how she really began, was secreting Union prisoners into this room, getting information from them, and then sending them onto Northern lines.
How would she get people into that room with so many critics and other spies sort of circling around her?
Well, Elizabeth was ingenious and wealthy. Fortunately, she was wealthy, and she knew exactly who to bribe in Richmond, who would look the other way, who would take her money. And she was able to have some high place sources in prisons and very strategically arranged people in all levels of the Confederate government. And she also used her African-American servants. She freed all of the family slaves, and she would station them around the perimeter of the prison. So once the soldiers came out, they led them directly to Elizabeth's home, and she took it from there. She also made sure they had Confederate uniforms made waiting for them so that that would be part of their disguise as they slipped through the lines.
My goodness. And with Union prisoners, what else did she do to get messages to them?
Oh, this was an interesting part of her research. I was really fortunate to connect with Elizabeth's brothers, a descendant of her brothers. He had two daughters, and I talked with the great-grandson of one of these daughters, and he gave me some insights into her operation that had never been published before, including John Van Loo, Elizabeth's brother's role in the network. He had inherited the family hardware business and would take blank purchase orders and invoices from the hardware business, and he would fill them out as if they were, you know, typical business documents, but each number that he put down corresponded to certain military technology. For example, 30 hammers might be 30,000 piece of artillery. And so each one thing corresponded. And so when he went across the lines and somebody searched his papers, nothing looked suspicious. And I thought that was really ingenious.
Oh, that's amazing. Is that the special cipher that she used to send messages to agents in Washington about Confederate troop movements, what you just described there?
Oh, that was later. No. This was the interesting thing about Union espionage was how disorganized it was in the beginning. And Elizabeth worked on her own for quite a bit. She was running her own ring with John and trying to get messages to Washington without there being any sort of centralized force recognizing her contributions. Like, she would just get it to people. But their generals weren't coordinating until about 1863 when they formed the Bureau of Military Intelligence. And only then did they say, oh my God, we really need to formally recruit this woman in Richmond, give her a cipher, and put her to work for Ulysses S. Grant. So it was kind of an ad hoc operation up until later on in the war.
She also wore disguises. Elizabeth Van Loo wore disguises. What kind of disguises?
Well, she just did not want to be immediately recognizable on the street. She was genuinely terrified for her life. Confederate detectives were following her. Her neighbors hated her. She was receiving these death threats. So Elizabeth was a very wealthy woman, and she would leave her, you know, elaborate gowns at home and put on a homespun dress, put on a simple cotton dress. She would put on a bonnet, and she would stuff her cheeks full of cotton. And she would just really sort of keep to herself and put her head down and hope that nobody recognized her and followed her around Richmond Street.
This former slave that she managed to get inside the Confederate White House, to infiltrate the Confederate White House, tell us a little more about how she found the right slave and got that slave inside that building.
Oh, it's just a fascinating part of the story. Mary Jane Bowser grew up in the Van Loo family. She was born into slavery in their family. And Elizabeth freed her, I think, when she was about 4 years old, and actually took the step of having her baptized at the city's primarily white church, a preeminent church. And she took Mary Jane under her wing very early and treated her almost as a daughter. She sent her to be educated, which, as I said, was illegal for her to do that, and especially illegal for her to bring her back to Richmond after she had been educated. And she really recognized something special in Mary Jane, an intelligence. And Verena Davis, the Confederate First Lady, had put out word that she needed servants. She needed help. She was setting up her White House staff. And Elizabeth got the idea that she was going to pay Verena Davis a visit. And so she does. And she says, well, you know, I have a servant for you. She's not a very bright girl. She falters in the kitchen. She's not the best servant you would have had, but she'll do enough. She'll do well enough for you that I think you should give her a try. And so Mary Jane Bowser goes over to the Confederate White House and starts just easing herself into the family, the customs and getting comfortable. And she was sort of a sleeper agent, as they say, until Elizabeth gave the word that she needed her to start spying.
And once she did, she proved to be a heck of a spy.
Oh, absolutely. Mary Jane had a photographic memory and would report conversations that Jefferson Davis had. She would memorize the maps on his desk. And she would, a very ingenious way of delivering this information, she would sew it up into Verena Davis's gowns and bring them over to a pre-selected seamstress who was in on the whole thing for repair, quote unquote. This seamstress was a very good friend of the Van Loo family, and she knew what was going on. And so the seamstress would rip up the hems of Verena Davis's gowns and retrieve the information and give it to Elizabeth, and it would set on that way. So they had a very specific relay system in place that worked brilliantly.
And it's amazing to think about all this happening inside the Confederate White House. And I mentioned a while ago that I was just there a couple of weeks ago. The only building, yeah, I think, anywhere in the country where both Abraham Lincoln and Jeff Davis were in, not at the same time, but were both in it at one point or another. Abraham Lincoln arriving just after Jeff Davis fled Richmond, fled the Confederate White House, and Lincoln is walking through that house, sitting at Jeff Davis's desk and conducting meetings at a point like that. Just absolutely amazing to think about that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with Karen Abbott about her very fast-paced new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. If you want to join our conversation with your questions about all of this, such a fascinating story, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here again. Again, 816-235-2888. You know, Rose O'Neill Greenhow was a widow who engaged in affairs with powerful northern politicians, and she used her daughter to send information to southern generals. Tell us about Rose O'Neill Greenhow.
Yeah, she was in a very difficult position when the war broke out. In the years leading up to the war, she had lost 5 children within 4 years. She had lost her husband in a freak accident. She had lost her financial stability, and she had lost her access to the White House. She had been very good friends with Democratic politicians leading up to the war. She'd even been an advisor to President James Buchanan. So she lost all of this with the election of Lincoln and with the Republicans coming into power. And Rose was desperate to get this back and would have done anything. And so when a Confederate captain approaches her in spring of 1861 and says, "Do you want to operate a Confederate spy ring in Washington, D.C.?" Rose jumps at the chance. And she gets a cipher, and she begins memorizing the cipher, and she recruits people from all walks of life, and including that courier who delivered the message to Beauregard, for uncoiling the bun in her hair. Yeah. And she also did use her daughter, Little Rose. She would tuck and cipher dispatches into Little Rose's pantalettes, send the girl out into the yard, and at the appointed hour, one of Rose's spies would come by and pick up the message, and she would exchange information in that way.
Wow. Let's go to some calls here. Florence from Kansas City, Missouri. Florence, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Yes, very interesting show. Thank you for taking my show. I would like to ask the guest, did the women invent espionage practice for the Civil War, or were their male counterparts? Was there an established espionage already and they jumped on board? Or did the women establish it, or did they have their male counterparts who established it?
It's a good question. There were definitely male spies, and they conducted business quite differently. As you can imagine, the male spies did not have the benefit of a 6-foot diameter crinoline with which to tie dispatches and sabers and pistols, and they did not hide things up in their hair. But there were male spies, and they did have their own methods of secreting information about. One of my favorite male spies I ran into was a guy by the name of Benjamin Franklin Stringfellow, who worked for Confederate General Jeb Stuart. And he was 94 pounds and blonde and blue-eyed and had fine features. And one of his comrades said, a waist like a girl's. And he would go dress up in elaborate gowns and call himself Sally Martson and go to Union military balls. And he would glean information about Ulysses S. Grant from his dance partners at these balls. So it just goes to prove that it was not only the women who were cross-dressing during the Civil War, the men were also, had their devious behaviors, too.
Okay, so it was a lot of masquerading going on along with the spying.
Yes, definitely. Masquerading on both sides was, I think, a primary tactic of good espionage work.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Florence.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
A listener wants to know, Karen, how many cities and sites did you visit in researching the book?
Oh, God. Washington, D.C. I spent quite a bit of time there. Richmond, Virginia, the Shenandoah Valley, North Carolina. I went to Parkersburg, West Virginia, even. I was the only person on the airplane. It was sort of a Twilight Zone episode. And there was Belle Boyd had a biography written about her back in the 1940s. And I found the papers of that biographer who had a wealth of information and that archives that hadn't been touched in 50 years. I also met with Elizabeth's, the descendant of Elizabeth's brother. I went up to Connecticut to meet with him. Everywhere I could go, I think I went.
It sounded just like an enormous scavenger hunt as you made your way around.
It was, and just sort of, each more fine, more fascinating than the last. I was never disappointed by any of the trips.
You know, we were talking about Rose O'Neill Greenhow, this notion that she helped get information and defeat the Union at Bull Run. What information did she pass on to the generals, the Southern generals, in connection with the Bull Run?
Oh, she talked about when the Union soldiers were preparing to advance. So it was sort of the specific date that they were ready to go. Yeah. So Beauregard knew when and where to have his men lined up and prepared.
The famous detective Alan Pinkerton eventually captured her. How did he do that?
This is one of my favorite parts of the book. I just love Pinkerton is sort of a comic relief in many spots in the book. And Pinkerton was hired to do Secret Service work for the Union government. And Rose O'Neill Greenhow was his first assignment. He was ordered to conduct a stakeout of her. And he one night took two of his best detectives to Rose's home. She lived on Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C. She always said it was, quote, within rifle range of the White House. Pinkerton stands on his men's shoulders and peers into Rose's window. And what does he see but Rose on the couch with the traitorous Union captain? They're poring over maps and fortifications, and the traitorous Union captain is giving all sorts of confidential information. And then the pair start furiously kissing. And Pinkerton is enraged by this scene and decides that Rose must be apprehended at once.
Wow. Yeah, I'm wondering at the end of the day how important these women's actions were in sort of on the road to more equal rights for women down the road someday. How do you see that as a precursor to what would come later?
That's a great question. And one of the takeaways I sort of had about women's roles in the Civil War and how they affected women, women were subsequently affected after the war. It really changed the whole notion of women's relationships with men, with the family, what their role in family life was. In the antebellum years, a woman had to have a formal letter of introduction for a prospective suitor. There was a very formal process where a letter had to come into play, the meeting of the parents, a meeting of the neighbors, of the acquaintances. This process could last for years. And of course, all dates were chaperoned very carefully, and there was not much freedom. But with the onset of the war, all of these rules laxed and loosened, and women had a newfound freedom and also a likelier chance of heartbreak. They would go off to camps and be serenaded by men and go on scandalous carriage rides, and there was greater physical intimacy. And after the war, the men came back with amputees, or they were widows, and women had to take charge of everything.
Hmm. Well, Karen Abbott is the author of Liar, Tempter, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. And Karen, I enjoyed having you. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Thanks for having me, Steve.